Hi everyone, and thank you for joining us once again on Lit Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Thea. Today, I'm joined by David Chewin to talk about his latest book, The Magical Decade, a personal memoir and popular history of 1965-1975. David Chewin grew up in Chicago. He eventually received his medical degree from University of Michigan and became a medical practitioner. However, David was also a journalist in his teenage years and covered the Apollo 11 moon launch, which he went on to write about in his first book, I Was a Teenage Space Reporter. In The Magical Decade, David synthesizes by topic his memories of the time between 1965 and 1975 with brief histories of the events and their backgrounds, making this a unique personal memoir of a life-changing decade for many people in America. Hi, David. Thank you very much for joining us on the Lit Radio podcast. It's a great pleasure to be speaking with you about your second book, The Magical Decade. And my first question is, why did you decide to write the book?
Well, Taya, it's a pleasure to talk to you and to be on Lit Radio. I really had three audiences in mind when I wrote the book. The initial impetus was to write it for my family. I have two children and a granddaughter, and I kind of wanted to put down on paper some of my reminiscences of the time when I was growing up. Between 1965 and 1975, I was between the ages of 15 and 25, and this was very formative years in my development. I started to write this type of thing, and then I realized that what I was doing was actually writing a story of me and my fellow baby boomers, actually. Baby boomers are the generation that was born right after World War II, so from 1946 to 1964. And I was kind of born in the middle there. I was born in 1950 in mid-century America. And because of luck and timing and curiosity on my part, during that 10 years, I ended up participating in and witnessing some of the key instances of that decade. I called it the magic years because I would argue that it was an unprecedented 10 years of changes in every field of endeavor, ranging from international politics to technology to big changes in culture. It was a really unique period of time.
Absolutely. You did explain why you called it Magical Decade, but was it also magical for you in a personal plan?
Yeah, it was. When I was 15, I was a sophomore in high school. We had just moved from the city of Chicago to one of the suburbs. I was a somewhat naive sophomore in high school. And it was a time of great changes when in 1965, the war in Vietnam was raging. There was major escalation. And ended up with more than 500,000 troops being sent from the United States to Vietnam. It was a time of great cultural changes, too. One of the highlights of that first year for me was being able to attend live and in person the Beatles concert at Comiskey Park, the baseball stadium in Chicago. It was a time of great changes culturally, too, with, for example, an American television show, which I believe originated in England, an earlier version called All in the Family. But this completely changed situation comedies. There were new plays such as Hair, and also plays such as Rocky Horror Show, both of which were revolutionary kind of in their own right. So it was really a time of unprecedented changes.
Absolutely. Could you tell us a little bit more about yourself during that period? What were you doing at the time?
Okay, so as I just mentioned, the period started with me being a sophomore in a new suburban high school, a very different environment than when I lived actually in the city of Chicago itself. Chicago at that point had a lot of segregated communities in terms of black versus white Americans. There was what we call de facto segregation still. And this was mainly a result of housing patterns. At that point, there was still officially segregation in the south of the United States. Not officially in the north, but it turned out that way because of housing patterns. So, for example, when we moved to the suburbs, there were practically no African Americans in my classes. And that began to change over time with progress in civil rights. In March 65, right at the beginning of the magical decade, was a historic event called Bloody Sunday, in which marchers were going from Selma, Alabama to the state capitol to press for voting rights. And the marchers were actually attacked by Alabama state police. This led to big changes. And eventually, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, so that there were changes in that regard. Now, as I graduated high school in 1968, the Vietnam War was at its height at that point, and the U.S. casualties had increased to over 18,000 deaths per year killed in action. And this was really the major international trauma, the major international issue for the United States and its allies at that point. So I graduated high school in 1968, and I attended the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And while there, I made a decision to join the Michigan Daily. Michigan Daily is the independent student newspaper there. And it's been in existence since 1890, is run and produced by the students at the University of Michigan. In recent years, there has never been a journalism department as such there, but the Michigan Daily functioned as that, and hundreds of journalists received kind of on-the-job training there. And by joining the Michigan Daily, that allowed me access to and the ability to be an eyewitness to a number of historical events there. Just one group of the events was Ann Arbor was a hotbed for anti-war activity against the Vietnam War. Virtually everybody on the staff of the Michigan Daily was event against the war in Vietnam. Still, 50 years later, I strongly believe that that was the correct position to take. The war was essentially a civil war between a dictatorship in the north, which was communist, and a dictatorship in the south, which was non-communist, which got United States support. So it was based on false premises because people argued in favor of the war that it would prevent the spread of communism through Asia. And the historical fact is that the Chinese, Vietnamese, and Russians had hated each other for decades and decades. And there was no monolithic communism. And this was especially true since the fall of Stalin in the 1950s. Also, it was a war that, especially at the beginning, was very unfair because there was a draft into the military armed forces of the US. And basically, it was a very unfair draft because it mainly affected poor people and people of color. were disproportionately sent to Vietnam. In 1970, they changed to a lottery system where every person were it depended on their birth date whether they were drafted into the military or not. So they had this draft lottery. But even then, it was unfair because local draft boards had discretion. And the classic example of that is Donald Trump got out of going to Vietnam because of alleged flat feet that made him, at the time, allegedly militarily unfit to go to Vietnam. And so that was a there was a very stressful environment for students because they needed to stay in school if they dropped out of school or had academic problems and they didn't fit the criteria for a student deferment, then they faced risks of being sent to Vietnam. In 1972, I graduated undergraduate from the University of Michigan and started medical school. And at that time was the start of the computer revolution. I did some research in the Department of Human Genetics at University of Michigan, where we had to analyze a lot of data. And the only computers then were these large mainframe computers that took up an entire room. And data was entered onto punch cards. And then these punch cards were left at the computing center overnight and then were analyzed. And the data was presented in these large reams of paper the next day. And I remember very carefully carrying a cardboard box with the cards in it and praying that I didn't drop them, because if I dropped the box and all the cards got mixed up, then I would have to re-enter the whole thing again. You have to remember that at that point, there were no personal computers, there was no internet, and technology was very primitive. By 1975, the end of the magical decade, I was finishing up medical school in Ann Arbor. And while I didn't have time or the ability to cover political events at that point, I still experienced some of the cultural changes of the time. You remember at the beginning of the magical decade, I went to the Beatles concert. Towards the end, I went to a concert in Ann Arbor with Bob Dylan and the band. These were two of the kind of great cultural shifts during the magical decade, with the British invasion starting in the mid-60s, and then more American homegrown music with Woodstock in 1969, and then with the other musicians in the 1970s. And as far as the musician, one of the things that I had to decide in 1969, I had a dilemma on my hands, was whether to go to Woodstock, which everybody had heard about was coming up, or whether to attend the first moon launch with Apollo 11. And it was a difficult decision at the time, Woodstock or the moon, basically. And I decided to go and see the moon launch. My calculus was that this was the first time people were going to actually had to land on the moon, and that there would be other rock concerts besides just Woodstock. Little did we realize that Woodstock was also probably fairly unique as far as music festivals go. So between 1965 and 75, there were really tremendous changes in the United States and indeed around the world, as far as culture, as far as technology, as far as international events.
Yeah, absolutely. And you did mention that in 1969, you were able to cover the first moon landing. And that's also a big part of your first book, I Was a Teenage Space Reporter. So could you tell us a little bit more about that experience and what it was like for you to cover that historical event?
Well, I'd been interested in space since the launch of the first Russian space unmanned satellite, Sputnik 1, in October 1957. I was 7 years old then, and like a lot of kids my age at that point, I was fascinated by space exploration. And this was heightened when the first humans started going to space, the Russian Yuri Gagarin in April 1961, and then Alan Shepard, the US astronaut, on a suborbital flight in May 1961. So I had been interested in space for many years. I kind of looked up to the early American astronauts. When I went to the University of Michigan on the daily, it seems like I was the only member of the staff who was at all interested in space, because they were all humanities majors and philosophy majors and things like that. And science and especially space were kind of off the radar for them. So I became the kind of unofficial daily space reporter. When there were major events happening, I would be the one asked to write an editorial, even though I was a lonely, merely a freshman on the staff. So a friend of mine, a school age friend of mine who I grew up with in Chicago, was also interested in the space. And in December 1968, we had both turned 18, so we could kind of travel on our own. And over Christmas break, when the Apollo 8 spacecraft was orbiting the moon for the first time, we said to ourselves, let's try and go see a Saturn V launch this huge moon rocket. And we looked at our school calendars and saw that Apollo 11 was scheduled for July. And so we decided to make that as a goal. It was easy to get approval to cover the Apollo 11 for the Michigan Daily as long as they didn't have to pay for it. Covering a rocket launch was not really high on their list of priorities. But when I said that we would pay for the expenses ourselves, they readily agreed. The harder nut to crack was getting approval from NASA to actually have press credentials. At that point, NASA did not give accreditation for press passes to college journalists because it considered them as students, not as quote unquote real reporters. And so this was upsetting. But as luck would have it, one of the Daily senior editors was in Washington that summer. As head of the College Press Service, which was a group of college newspapers. And because he was right there in Washington, he was able to go into the NASA Public Affairs office and explain that I wouldn't be covering it just for the Michigan Daily, but my friend Marv Rubenstein and I would actually be covering it for all the college press. And he must have been pretty persuasive, because about a month before the launch, I got a letter from him saying that we had been approved for NASA press passes. And this made all the difference in the world, because it gave us access to press conferences. For example, a so-called center director press conference with Wernher von Braun, the German rocket scientist, and Kurt Debus and Robert Gilruth. These were like the head of the main NASA centers. We were right in the press conferences with them. Also, we were able to get on special tours. We were able to get within 1,000 feet of the actual moon rocket sitting out on pad 39A. And we were able, inside the assembly building, actually get right to the base of the Saturn V for the next Apollo moon mission. And the day of the launch, Marv and I got up at 4:30 in the morning and went on NASA buses to the Space Center, where the astronauts were getting into their white spacesuits. And we were about one of maybe about 200 press people, photographers and reporters there, to actually watch them step out of the building and head down the ramp to the so-called Astrovan, the van that took them to the launch pad. And so it was really one of the high points of the trip to see the first men to set foot on the moon, take their last steps on Earth to head out to the pad. And then we took another bus to watch the launch from the so-called VIP stands. NASA had invited about 5,000 dignitaries to watch the launch close up from 3 miles away. Now, you might say, why 3 miles away? Well, that's the closest they would allow anybody to go, because if the rocket exploded, if you were any closer, you would most certainly die. And so it was a safety thing. But everybody who was anybody was there. Former President Johnson and his wife were there. And I saw him and got some pictures of him. There were American actors like Hugh O'Brien and American TV personalities such as Johnny Carson and Ed McMahon, and all kinds of military and political figures. To see that rocket actually take off was an incredible experience. So there was a dot of yellow light at the base of the pad, and then flames shot out from either side, deflected by these concrete structures. And so flames shot out from either side of the rocket, and then it just seemed to sit there. And we were wondering if everything was okay. It just sat there, and you couldn't hear anything. Light travels faster than sound. And so it took a few seconds before we could actually start hearing anything. And the rocket very slowly started to rise off the pad. And then there was this thunderous roar. You could actually feel sound waves hitting your chest as they came from there. And at increasing speed, the rocket took off and headed towards the moon. And I've always said that it was really a life-changing experience for me. It was it's one of the high points of the magical decade for me.
Wow, it really sounds like you had a great experience back there. But now I would like to ask you about the pop culture of the magical decade. So you've already told us about you attending the Beatles concert, and you also mentioned some other kinds of music that were popular back then. But overall, how would you describe the American pop culture of that period?
Well, the music of that era is absolutely classic. Not only the British invasion, which at the beginning of that period was on top, but then also there was the tremendous amount of cultural change in that from resulting from the Woodstock Music Festival in August 1969, and then also a lot of American pop groups as well. Towards the end of the magical decade, was the onset of a trend which I did not like, and that was disco. Disco started about the middle of the 1970s with clubs called discotheques that were in some of the large cities. While I liked a few of the disco artists, overall I thought it was a real backward step music-wise. To go from the Beatles and Woodstock to degenerate into disco music. And as far as other aspects of American pop culture, there was a lot of musical changes in that. And I mentioned some of the musical movies, and some of those movies included the Godfather series, which was a special favorite of mine. Godfather 1 and 2 were both released in the magical decade, and it really, in a way, kind of revolutionized that genre of film. The intensity, the bloodshed, the swearing, the violence, was a real change. And these were very, very popular movies, and they had huge audiences, and also received great reviews from the critics as well. Another favorite movie of mine from that period that was definitely different was the movie Midnight Cowboy with Dustin Hoffman and John Voight. This was the only movie to win an Academy Award that had a R rating at I'm sorry, an X rating at first. Later it was changed to an R rating, but there weren't too many movies of the time winning awards involving would-be male prostitutes and things like that. The other types of things were some of the plays of the time. And again, these were revolutionary too. For example, Rocky Horror Show opened in London in 1970s. And again, this was different, about a transvestite scientist in a comedy and musical. Other types of revolutionary plays included the musical Hair, which was anti-war and had positive things to say about the drug culture, and even featured full frontal nudity, which was extremely unusual at that stage. Again, the thing that was so impressive about the magical decade was that there were all these changes, but it was all going on all at once. There was also less serious stuff too. For example, some of the fads of the magical decade. In toys, there were fads like Big Wheels, which was a toy tricycle that kind of made big changes in that. And a lot of kids learned how to ride a bicycle, starting with these big wheel tricycles. There was other fads like pet rocks. One of the big pet fads of the mid-1970s were pet rocks, which were a kind of a gag gift where round stones from Mexican beaches were sold for $1 each with a story and everything. And it was the most popular toy fad in 1975. But probably one of the biggest changes during this period was the onset of the computer revolution. And towards the end of the magical decade was the first home computer kit. Altair was the brand. And it was sold as kind of a hobby kit. And this was the first home computer set. The other thing that occurred then were the first electronic watches. This was something new as well. And also the start of the internet. The US Defense Department developed something called ARPANET, ARPA, Advanced Research Projects Agency, developed a way of allowing computers to talk to each other across the country. And so this was the start of the internet and revolutionized that whole thing. And again, you got to remember that there were no mobile phones then, no car phones, no mobile phones. When I phoned in my Apollo 11 story from Cape Canaveral, I had to go to what was called a phone booth then, which our younger listeners may not be real familiar with. But I had to go to a phone booth then, dial up with a rotary phone the editorial office, and dictate word for word my Apollo 11 story. This is totally different than journalism now, where everything is just instantly uploaded to the way. But it was, especially going back, it was such a revolutionary time. And I think without that 10 years, if you subtract that, things were just so different then And the other thing is that politically, many of the same topics that were matter of controversy then are matters of controversy now. That 50 years later, the conversation really hasn't changed. A couple of examples, for example, in 1973 in the United States, in Roe versus Wade, the U.S. Supreme Court allowed abortion essentially anytime after the first trimester. And then this was in the Dobbs case 2 years ago, this was reversed. So we're talking about abortion now, just like we were 50 years ago. In the matter of criminal justice and equality in policing, I mentioned Bloody Sunday before and discrimination against African Americans. And yet again, with the George Floyd case and the situation with the unequal policing, the same issues are happening 50 years later. And so in some ways, the more things change, the more they remain the same.
Yeah, it's very interesting what you're saying, that some of the problems that were present 50 years ago and we're still talking about them now. And actually, and my next question is very relevant to that. So in the book, you share lessons from the magical decade that are still relevant today. So could you share two or three of those lessons with us now?
Okay, I think that that's good. And that's something that as I was writing this, I was kind of thinking through, have we learned anything over the last 50 years or not? So one of the main lessons in terms of international relations is that we should avoid foreign wars, especially foreign civil wars. The Vietnam War was a total disaster for the United States. The total US casualties was over 52,000 deaths in the Vietnam conflict. And since then, when we've gotten involved in foreign civil wars, maybe to not that extent, but we've seen some of these same things happen. And a couple of examples are the war in Iraq, which several thousand US soldiers were killed. It was also started on false premises that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, which turned out to be wrong. The other example of a foreign civil war was the situation in Afghanistan. The United States went in after 9/11, killed Osama bin Laden, and there were folks who wanted the US to stay in Afghanistan to so-called nation build there. And even though it was probably done in the wrong way, I think cooler heads realized that this again was one of these civil wars that the United States had no reasonable expectation of winning. And so the U.S. kind of abandoned the Afghanistanis, who had supported the U.S. And the Taliban is unfortunately in charge there now. And then this has had disastrous results, for example, for the women of Afghanistan, who've been suppressed. So that avoiding foreign wars, I think, is important. The other thing that I think is important is that the United States and similar countries have gained from the what's been called the Arc of Freedom getting larger. Martin Luther King gave a speech in which he said the arc of justice may be long, but it eventually opens up, as to paraphrase him. And so in the last 50 years, the rights and responsibilities and abilities of women have increased tremendously. And the first U.S. woman to fly in space, Sally Ride, didn't fly until 1983. And the reason that it took that long was that the first astronauts had to be test pilots. And the reason that there were no U.S. test pilot who were female was that females couldn't be pilots, just regular pilots in the Air Force. And so this changed over the years to a point where Colonel Eileen Collins actually commanded a space shuttle mission, as well as some other women too. So women have, during the magical decade, started to break through this glass ceiling that would prevent women from being promoted. Another example is the current Vice President of the United States, Kamala Harris, is a so-called heartbeat away from the presidency. Whatever one may think of her politically, she broke through an additional glass ceiling. And one wonders when the first female president of the United States will occur. There's also, as mentioned several times before, the rights and the African Americans has increased tremendously from fighting for voting rights in the 1960s. And it's fascinating now, again, 50 years later, that voting rights and ability to cast absentee ballots and things like that are back in the news again. And then there's some less serious lessons. One is to save your old clothes, because especially with men's clothes, there's like a 20-year pendulum of the widths of men's ties. If you look back at pictures of the Beatles from the mid-1960s at the start of the magical decade, they had ties, these thin, narrow ties that were maybe 2-inch widths. And then a few years later, the men's ties became very, very wide, like 5-inch ties. And it seems like there's maybe a 20-year cycle. So in terms of clothing, what goes around comes around. This is also true with women's clothes, with hem lengths. So the again, the more things change, the more they remain the same. And I think we get a better understanding of our current politics and culture by looking back 50 years and seeing what we've learned and what perhaps we haven't learned since then. It's been a fascinating half century, and I really think that this book will be enjoyed by fellow baby boomers because it's kind of the story of their lives. And it will also be enjoyed by people who hear these stories about the 60s and 70s, and some of which are true and some of which were not true. And it's a relevant time as we baby boomers get older to look back and to see what we accomplished. And I'm proud of the generation that I'm from. Sometimes baby boomers get a bad rap, but I think that considering the difficult and revolutionary circumstances, we did a pretty darn good job of progress, and that culture, both here in the U.S. and also abroad, is more fair, is more equal, and is more prosperous and is more technologically advanced than we were 50 years ago.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, David, for that very exciting conversation. And I would encourage our listeners to, of course, buy the book, The Magical Decade, and read more about the story of that time period and your lessons that are still relevant today. But thank you very much for your time to speak with me today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you keep an eye on our social media at Lit Publishing on LinkedIn, X, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. See you next time on Lit Radio Podcast.